Good morning, Dorian. So thank you very much for accepting to speak after my lectures at Collège de France. I think it's a great addition to the material I presented. We've known each other 25 years. You're a professor at Oxford now, and I've probably read your papers even before then, maybe in the 80s. And I've always enjoyed the way you do science. So I'm excited to hear what you have to say about games and economies and their convergence towards equilibrium. Thank you,
Thanks,
Don.
JP. I appreciate it. It's an honor to be here, and I look forward. Hopefully, I can enlighten people on this. Today, I'm going to talk about the question of why does the economy change? The economy is changing all the time. It's one of the major subjects in newspapers. You open the newspaper, and they talk about whether the stock market's up or down, whether GDP is up or down, what is unemployment doing, and these changes are very important to all of us because people suffer when things get bad and they thrive when things are going well. And it's interesting that there's a fundamental debate in economics about what, even at the most qualitative level, what is it that's actually causing these changes to take place? And the two possibilities are essentially, on one hand, the idea that there are external shocks. There are things from outside the economy that cause changes to happen. A good example of that would be the COVID pandemic that we're still trying to get out of, where clearly the effects on the economy that the pandemic had aren't, they don't have to do with the economy. They have to do with the fact that there's a virus, and the virus causes people to become unemployed because of the danger of it, them infecting each other. So that's an outside shock. And the other example would be endogenous dynamics. So somehow the economy is acting on itself and causing changes that come from within the economy. So are things from without or from within? Of course, you could have a combination of both, as we see with COVID. There's at least, we know there's external shocks. But my suspicion is that a lot of economic dynamics, like the great financial crisis or the depression, are things that are really coming from inside the economy. So I'm going to address that question today. And under a standard macro model, things are exogenously driven. So the models that central banks use, the models that treasury departments use, they're all assuming that everything that changes in the economy is coming from outside. And this was described by Wicksell as a rocking horse economy in 1914 already, or something like that. And under this idea, the economy sits in equilibrium. The shock knocks it away. It's like somebody pushes the rocking horse, and then the economy moves back towards the equilibrium, and then another shock knocks it away. And you keep having this happen over and over again. And if you look at one of the standard models that central banks use, like the Smets-Vouders model, there's seven different kinds of shocks that have to do with things like changes in labor productivity, risk perception, technological improvement, random changes to wages or prices, spending and monetary policy. So they assume there's actually seven kinds of different shocks hitting the economy, and they try and compare what the economy is doing to what the model says it should do and back out what those seven shocks were. Rather complicated process. Now, that said, it's not impossible for these models to show chaos. This has been known for a long time, since sometime in the early 80s. And so chaos is a form of endogenous dynamics. I'll say more about it in the beginning. And but the consensus from the work that was done in the 80s, leading up to this review paper by Boldrin and Woodford in 1990, is that while they could display chaos, that it required unusual parameters. That is, if you look at the models who have shown that something, some endogenous dynamics is happening, then you have to turn things into a funny place. For example, you have to assume that people have very little foresight. You have to use very low discount rates. And in fact, this was in response to a paper by Jose Shenkman in 1975, which is referred proving what's called a turnpike theorem, that seemed to show that if people have enough foresight and you take the framework of a standard macro model, that everything should go to a fixed point. And so you shouldn't see things would settle down in the absence of outside disturbance. Equilibrium really does mean steady state of rest. Though in principle, equilibrium could also mean chaos. Now, this conclusion that chaos isn't important for the economy was reinforced by some other papers that happened in the late 80s. Economists took things that fluid dynamicists and others were using, and they took data from the economy, like long runs of the S&P index or long runs of macroeconomic indices. And they showed there was no evidence of low dimensional chaos in the data. So from the point of view of the mainstream field, that's the end of the story. There was nothing else to say. Done, because chaos is not relevant for economics. But there was a misunderstanding here that's part of what I want to clear up in this talk at the beginning, and then I'll go back and address through other means. That is really all these tests showed is that there was no high dimensional chaos. That is, if you took these same tests and you, for example, applied them to the weather, so let's say you take a time series of meteorological fluctuations, a system that we know is chaotic, you wouldn't get any evidence for chaos there either. Why? Because it's very high dimensional chaos. You can only get evidence for those kind of things when you have systems that are really isolated, we have very long time series, and where the chaos is very low dimensional. Otherwise, the curse of dimensionality overwhelms you. So I don't think that was very conclusive. If you take a system like the economy that we know is pretty complicated and we know has outside influences, things like the COVID epidemic, it would be very surprising if we saw low dimensional chaos. That doesn't mean this idea isn't useful for economics, though. Now, let me also maybe take a step back and draw on the early part of my career. You know, when I was a graduate student and early days in my career after that, I was an expert on chaos, detecting chaos in the real world, and thinking about how you can use cases where you do observe low dimensional chaos to do prediction. But I want to start with a very general term, because I've had economists tell me, we all believe that there's endogenous motion in the economy. But we're working on trying to figure out how that comes about. But chaos can't be the right explanation. Well, actually, it's the only possible explanation. And that's because we know from basic work, fundamental work in dynamical systems, that there's really only two kinds of endogenous motion. One is regular motion, which then happens on an end torus. That is, you have effectively a cycle. And you have some others, you may have another cycle with an incommensurate frequency, and those cycles are acting together, and the motion's still very regular and predictable, but you just have more than one endogenous oscillation. And in fact, the theory of turbulence used to be that you had many different tori as you excited a fluid more and more by driving away from equilibrium. Then you get more and more degrees of freedom excited. And it was just, things were so complicated that everything looked chaotic. But with those kind of motions, actually, things still remain predictable. If that were true, the weather would be very predictable, predictable far beyond what we have now and far into the future. But in fact, what Ruelle and Tockens showed in the late 70s is that chaos is actually generic. That is, if you take a system that you in some sense force away from equilibrium, if the nonlinearities become stronger and stronger, and they could only do this in some idealized setting called Axiom A, but in that setting, what they're able to show is that, as you do that, you can go from a fixed point to a limit cycle to a two torus, and then three tori become very unlikely, and four tori simply shouldn't occur. And so instead, what you should see is chaos. And in fact, There's a wide range of lore from people doing numerical experiments that strongly supports that in systems that are not axiom A. And what you see is that limit cycles, which is the example, limit cycles and tutori are the only real examples of endogenous motions that aren't chaotic. And those happen only near the transition. And as you drive the system further, you're quickly overwhelmed by chaos and chaos becomes generic. And I'll come back and say something about this later when I make some remarks about the ergodic theorem. But so the conclusion from this, you know, if you're a dynamical systems person, if you believe that the economy has endogenous motions, and particularly if they seem irregular, then chaos is the only sensible explanation. Now, I did put a little star up at the top of the slide to indicate that, you know, you can get tricked. Bob Deisler and I wrote a paper where we talked about deterministic noise amplifiers. So you can see situations where if the system has no noise tickling it, it sits at a fixed point and it's at rest. But as soon as you have even a little bit of noise, you start to see endogenous, well, you start to see lots of motion. And as you turn it up, you see more and more. And this occurs both when there's parts of the state space that are unstable and parts that are stable, but on average, the motion is still stable. And it also occurs in open systems where you have spatial degrees of freedom and you have something like a flow. And to be honest, from a dynamical systems point of view, we don't totally understand that. But there were some very nice examples of simulations where you put a little bit of noise in and you suddenly see lots of turbulence that you don't see otherwise. It's also known from experiments, actually, on things like pipe flow. Okay, so if the economy is showing endogenous motion, it almost has to be chaos. Now, I made one other note there. There's a recent paper that I really like by Paul Beaudry and two collaborators, where they take a standard macro model and they show that if you have strategic complementarities, which is a form of nonlinearity where, let's say, when the economy is doing well, interest rates get really low, which makes people overinvest, which then causes an overshoot. You have things like strategic complementarities, you can get a limit cycle, even with reasonable parameters. And then they argue that, well, so maybe what's going on is you have a limit cycle and you have stochastic noise tickling that limit cycle or perturbing the limit cycle. And, that's, again, it's a bit implausible because then you really have to say that the irregularities in business cycles are really all driven by the stochastic part, because a limit cycle ought to say we have a business cycle exactly every 7 years or every 10 years, a fixed period. And as I said, it's a transition phenomenon. So, all right, let me just make a few more caveats before I dive into the more technical results. You know, there's of course some other reasons why chaos might not be relevant. The dynamics may be very special in the economy. If people really have the foresight that Shankman assumed in the Turnpike theorem, then, and if the structure of the economy is really like the macro models he was using, then he showed that things ought to settle into a fixed point. And in a way, it's not too surprising, though this goes back to a debate Jean-Philippe and I have had, actually. My insight here is that if you have agents that are really rational and very forward-looking, they can see the future and they can plan for that future so strongly that they take it into account in the present, and that's, in general, a stabilizing force. So I think that's the intuition behind this Turnpike theorem. The other explanation might just be there's insufficient nonlinear driving. You know, we know that fluids are great at displaying chaos, but they only display chaos when you drive them away from equilibrium. And so maybe the economy is just not being driven away from equilibrium in some sense. Of course, when I say that, you have to realize in that sentence, I'm using equilibrium in the sense it's used in physics. Equilibrium in economics is something quite different. And so we have to reconcile that. And I am going to argue that actually deviations, endogenous motion, I think, in the economy has to do with deviations from equilibrium. And so in other words, I'm going to argue that things break down due to bounded rationality, and I'm going to use normal form games to investigate that. So what do I mean? Well, let me just give an example of a normal form game. Take a game like rock, paper, scissors. So you have two players, and you know, I think probably everybody's played this game. You have rock, paper, and scissors. Rock beats scissors, scissors beats paper, and paper beats rock. And you move simultaneously. And so there's the three moves are shown in the rows and columns above, corresponding to the two players. And then we list the payoffs, which depend on the possible moves of the two players in the table below. So this -1, 1, 0, 0, 0 just reflects, okay, zero indicates if you both make the same move, you have a tie and you have to go again. And otherwise you get a payoff that's plus or minus one, depending on which of the two moves you made. We'll come back to rock, paper, scissors a bit later. Now, the normal way that game theorists think about games and that forms a lot of the intuition about equilibrium in the economy. And by the way, just a segue, you know, when John Nash originally proved, let me actually first explain what Nash equilibrium. So Nash equilibrium is a set of decisions such that no player can improve on their own. So in other words, given that you make that move, the other player can't make a better move as long as you're making that move. And so to come back to rock, paper, scissors, in rock, paper, scissors, the Nash equilibrium is randomly choose rock, paper, or scissors with probability a third. So if you do that, nobody can ever get on average better than you do. They may win one given go, but if you average over a long period of time, you're going to break even, at least break even with them. In fact, you can't beat them, but they also can't beat you. So that's not always true of Nash equilibria, but in that case it is. So when Nash came up with this idea, game theorists latched on to the idea of Nash equilibrium as a way to think about, really as a behavioral rule to connect game theory to reality. So if we assume that people are sufficiently rational that they play in Nash equilibrium, then it's just a question of figuring out which Nash equilibrium they will play if there's more than one. And in many simple games like rock, paper, scissors, there's only one. Now, of course, the competing idea to rationality is bounded rationality, that our reasoning capabilities are limited and they're different than constrained rationality. And that really we get by using heuristics and rules of thumb or myopic, imperfect reasoning in some form. In contrast to rational expectations, where we know the correct probabilities of all possible events, and so therefore we can just reason from first principles by, you know, averaging our utility over few possible outcomes, weighting the utility of each outcome according to its probability, and then figure out which decision is the best decision. Now, I played a trick with you on this slide because in fact, you know, I tried to impute Bobby Fischer. Okay, Bobby Fischer's in that case, but he's a brilliant chess player. But, you know, as if this is the epitome of rationality, but actually chess players, even Bobby Fischer, are not following rational expectations in that nobody can compute every possible outcome in chess. And that's why there is no known perfect chess game. You know, there's a joke that I actually heard from an economist, which is, you know, how did two economists play chess? And so the answer is they randomly choose for white or black. And then they argue whether under the Nash equilibrium, whether white or black wins. Okay, now there's a competing joke that I made up about how two physicists play chess. Two physicists play chess by beginning by getting quite drunk, and then they start randomly moving the pieces around the board, and they argue about how the interestingness of the game scales under changes in the number of squares or alterations in the nature of the pieces. And I'm, of course, being a physicist, I'm going to follow that latter strategy to try and understand this question. Now, I want to make another point that somehow I think it's lost in literature. When is rational expectations a reasonable approximation? There are situations where it works pretty well. And here I'm going to draw back on my experience as a young child. I think I was 9 years old when there was an outbreak of playing the game of tic-tac-toe in my school. It's called Noughts and Crosses in Britain. And so, you know, you make an X or an O and you try and get three in a row. And so we were having a lot of fun with that game. And then, okay, I proudly realized that even if I had to be the second player and be the O player, I could always get a draw out of the other player if I did things right. So I started doing that and my friends observed it and they all figured it out. And then it, you know, became a boring game. Well, what had happened? We had all discovered the Nash equilibrium of chess, or sorry, of tic-tac-toe. And so we were acting as, you know, rational players, even though we were only 9 years old. So there are circumstances where this idea is a good idea, but I'm gonna argue here that the key question about rational expectations depends on the game, on the setup. There are simple circumstances where this idea makes sense as a model of the world. There are many other circumstances where it does not make sense. And this leads me to this reasoning led me to a hypothesis that, well, it must be something about the complexity of the game that determines whether rational expectations is a reasonable approximation. So we're going to pursue that here in the rest of this talk. And we're going to try and understand, that is, when is Nash equilibrium a reasonable behavioral model, and when is it not a reasonable behavioral model? And now let me start. I want to illustrate another point here about heterogeneity. And I'm going to go back to the famous Keynesian beauty contest. You know, in Keynes's day, there were these beauty contests, this very politically incorrect now, for good reasons. But in Keynes's day, the newspapers would run a contest where they showed pictures of women, and then people would vote on which woman was the most beautiful woman. And if your vote coincided with the majority of the rest of the readership who entered, then your name would be put in a hat for a lottery to win a vacation or something like that. And so Keynes pointed out that it's really not about, there's no sense in which one woman's more beautiful than the other. It's about understanding which woman other people will think of as beautiful. And so then there's regression in trying to figure that out. So you can make up a game that's in that spirit that's easy to play. That is, if you have a group of people, you can ask the group of people to guess the number between 0 and 100. That's going to be 2/3 of the average guess that the group makes. So think about this for a minute. Imagine we're in a, you know, in a lecture hall. This works much better in a lecture hall than a Zoom talk, but we're in a lecture hall. And I ask you, all right, everybody's going to pick a number. And the person who wins the prize is going to be the one whose number is 2/3 of the average number that all of you have guessed. Now, what will you guess? Well, I'll jump to the answer. It actually, I discovered when I was doing this live, it's very embarrassing to actually make people guess, because some people have really embarrassing guesses. Like they guess numbers. Look, here's a Danish newspaper who did this, and they had, let's see, they had 19,000 people enter the game. So a large sample. People had to mail in their answers from the newspaper, and you can see what the histogram of the guesses were. And the first thing, you know, you might observe is that surprisingly, there are quite a few people that guessed a number higher than 66. Well, if you think about it for a minute, those guesses are all dead in the water, because even if everybody guessed 100, the winning answer would be 66. And so any guess above there is just simply a blunder. So, some people make serious blunders. And there's some other interesting structure in this picture, though. You'll notice there's a big spike at 50. If you thought everybody was going to guess 66, then 2/3 of 66 is 50. There's another big spike at 33. If you think people are going to guess 50, then 2/3 of that is 33. And then there's another spike below that, which actually is the winning value, the winning answer, which is 2/3 of 33. So you can see in this that, first of all, there's a huge diversity of reasoning abilities. Now, you'll notice there's also a spike at zero. And why is there a spike at zero? Well, zero is the Nash equilibrium, because if you think about it, if everybody was rational, we should all be driven to guess zero, because 2/3 of zero is zero. That's a fixed point. And in fact, so I'm putting this up there to illustrate that real people aren't following Nash equilibrium in a one-shot game. But what you can see that people do is they use some form of myopic reasoning to various levels, where they have a model for other people and guess accordingly. Now, the other response that, you know, an economist might make is that, well, what about if you played the game repeatedly? Well, if you played that game repeatedly, you're going to converge to the Nash equilibrium of zero, because, you know, the guesses will gradually be driven down. It won't happen in one go. It'll happen in a few goes, but that's where you'll end up. But what about other games? So let's go back and look again at rock, paper, scissors. So I looked at this, my gosh, a long time ago. I have the date in a minute. Was Yuzuru Satou and Eizo Akiyama. And so, as I already said, the Nash equilibrium of rock, paper, scissors is a third, a third, a third. You guess each rock, paper, scissors randomly with those probabilities. And so here we have two players, and we're going to use reinforcement learning. So we're going to use a particular flavor of reinforcement learning called experience-weighted attraction. The basic idea is players learn strategies based on their actions that were successful in the past. So you have this quantity Q, which in some sense is going to tell you how much Q mu I, if you're player mu, then how attracted are you to taking action I, and action I is like move I in the game, and choice is choice. And so the probability that you take a given player takes a given action is determined by some moving average in this last equation at the bottom of the slide of what you've done in the past, what Q has been in the past, and how successful each move has been as you played. And if something gets more successful, you're more inclined to make that move. And experience-weighted attraction is a name that was coined by Kammerer and Ho. They use it as a model to understand what people do in real experiments when you ask them to play simple games. And they claim it's a pretty good model for what people do. So we took that model. Actually, at the time, we didn't even know about Kammerer and Ho, but anyway, we took that model and we then applied it using the computer, where we have two simulated players, to rock, paper, scissors. We made a slight modification of the game. You see the payoff matrices below. So instead of having a tie be neutral, that is having zero, we give tie, one player gets a small payoff, and we make the payoffs slightly different for the two players. So one player is favored over the other. This turns out to make a big difference and make the dynamics much richer. Very simple game. And what happens, we discovered, is that the learning dynamics, when you do that, are equivalent to a deterministic Hamiltonian dynamical system. So like the ones we study in physics, and it's a system that can have either regular or chaotic orbits. So you get a phase space that looks something like this. X1 is the probability that player one plays rock, and Y2 is the probability that the other player plays scissors. And you see that there are some orbits shown as these kind of dark things where you're on tori, you're effectively, you're on a two torus in the state space. And so you should think that what you're doing here is slicing through a donut and seeing its outer shell. And depending on exactly where you start, you end up on a different donut. But then there's other orbits that just go all over the place that are chaotic. And that they may be trapped between some of these tori for a while, but they manage to diffuse through them and they end up all over the place. So it's kind of surprising that something as simple as rock, paper, and scissors can do this. And So anyway, that was a nice paper, but you should be a little suspicious about a result based on rock, paper, scissors, because as I already mentioned, rock, paper, scissors has this flat peculiar property that the Nash equilibrium is neither no better nor no worse than anything else. The score you're gonna get is always the same. So maybe it's special. So Tobias Gala and I, as you can see quite a few years later, 2011, our first result was in 2002. So that's how long I've been worrying about these questions. Tobias Gala and I did something a little bit different. So rather than choosing a specific game, we looked at an ensemble of games. So we chose payoffs so they're normally distributed, satisfying the idea that the expected payoff is some number gamma that we can, the expected correlation between payoffs. So we're taking the product of the payoff to player A and the payoff to player B of a given move, player A moves I and player B moves J, okay? Then the product is some number gamma divided by N, where N is the number of possible moves in the game. So in other words, we're gonna just draw these from a normal distribution, but we are going to introduce a correlation that turns out to be a very important parameter to control what's going on. And in fact, this gamma parameter has a property that it's -1. That means it's a zero sum game. So if player A wins, player B loses the same amount and vice versa. But you can make gamma zero. That means if player A wins, it's completely random whether B wins or loses. And in fact, if the number is positive, then you have a game where both players tend to win or lose together. And so you can now control that parameter to move it up or down. So we made up the games at random, and then we just studied lots and lots of random games. We just made them up and we looked to see what happened, and we automated it so that the computer could detect what happened. And we found a diagram that looks like the one I'm showing you here. That is, there's a key parameter in the memory algorithm that has to do with the memory loss. So as you turn up the memory loss, that means that players tend to forget what happened a long time ago. So as you move to the right in the diagram, it means the players are forgetting what happened in the distant past. And if you take it all the way over to the left at zero, that means that something that happened 1,000 moves ago is just as important in determining what you're going to do as something that happened on the last move. And on the vertical axis, we see the correlation of payoffs. So in the middle of the diagram, we have gamma equals zero. At the bottom of the diagram, we have zero sum games. At the top of the diagram, we have games where the players' moves are, players' payoffs are positively correlated. And so the diagram we saw was roughly like the one here. There's this region where you see a unique fixed point. You're not exactly at the Nash equilibrium, it turns out, but you're close to it. And then there's this chaotic region that happens whenever the game is competitive, that is where gamma is less than zero and where the memory loss is reasonably small. And then there's this complicated region on top where things do go to a fixed point, but there can be hundreds of these fixed points. So you don't know in advance that which fixed point you go to depends on the initial condition. So can be hundreds of Nash equilibria, and you don't know which Nash equilibrium you're going to go to. Now, and you can get dynamics that look like this. And I should say one other thing, which the other thing we did here is we studied the case where N is fairly large. So we assumed there were quite a few possible moves. That is, the game is complicated in the sense that there's many moves and you have more to learn when there's more moves. So in fact, these simulations that I'm going to show you were made in cases where there were 50 possible moves for each player. So a total of 50 times 2 degrees of freedom, and then actually have to subtract a couple for conservation of probability. So 98 possible degrees of freedom. So very high dimensional state space for the strategies. Now, so what I'm showing you in this picture here is an example of what happens when you don't go to a fixed point. So when you don't go to a fixed point, now what we're seeing is the payoff to we're seeing the payoff to the two, to the average payoff as a function of time, and we're seeing that for three of these possible dimensions. So there's three, we pick three possible moves out at random, and then we plot the we're plotting the probability weight that that move is getting as a function of time. So in the case on the left, we have a limit cycle, so a closed loop, and we're now plotting out of the 100 possible moves that the two players could make, we're now plotting the probability of making a given move as a function of time for three moves that we've selected at random. And so what you see is things are just periodically repeating themselves. We're on a limit cycle. For the next case, we have a low dimensional attractor, a dimension a little around three, a little greater than three. And we do the same thing. And what you see is now you're seeing irregular trajectories for these three possible, the probabilities of these three possible moves. And we look in another part of the state space, or sorry, in another part of the parameter space. So we're varying gamma as we change this, and we're varying alpha. So as we vary those, now we see a low dimension or a higher dimensional chaotic attractor of around dimension around 10. And you can see what a projection of a trajectory of the learning of the two players in the state space looks at through time. And then finally, we see a case where we really see high dimensional chaos, the dimensions around 65, and things look quite complicated. Okay. We also saw some other interesting things, like, you know, we saw intermittency, something that looks like clustered volatility in financial markets. So here, what we plot is the payoff to the two players as a function of time. And what you see is that's fluctuating. And there, but furthermore, it's the fluctuations are correlated. There are periods where the payoff changes a lot from move to move, and other periods where it doesn't change very much. And the periods where it changes a lot come in bursts. This is what's called clustered volatility in financial markets. So just for free from doing this, we saw that this is a generic property in the system. And let me, I thought I had one more plot in here, but I guess it didn't make it. Let me just come back to this and say that if you go inside of that chaotic region, you see a lot of very interesting structure, like the chaos is concentrated, the high dimensional chaos is very concentrated around the case where you have something that's close to zero sum, and where you also have alpha very low, close to zero. And that's where you get very high dimensional chaos. Now, we also studied together with James Saunders what happens if you have more than two players, because the results I've showed you so far are for two players. And what we saw is that if you have two players, then chaos becomes more and more widespread. And maybe to show you this diagram again, in this diagram, chaos is in this little triangular shaped wedge here. As you go to more players, this blue line that forms the marker between the fixed points and chaos translates to the right, so that chaos gets more and more area in this diagram. And so as alpha gets, the threshold for alpha gets, moves to the right, and chaos takes up more and more of the phase diagram. And so let me go back here. You see that as the number of players goes up, we're now plotting what that threshold is doing, and it's moving over to the right. Now, you might notice in this diagram, we plotted this as 1 over R. This R parameter is something a bit like the Reynolds number, and that it's really determining how likely you are to see chaos in this system. So we see more and more chaos as the number of players goes up. And if you look at the area in this parameter space that's chaotic, so here we're plotting on the x-axis the number of players, and we're plotting the area of chaos on the y-axis. As the number of players goes up, the area of chaos goes up and gets higher and higher as the number of players gets greater. Of course, as the number of players gets greater, the game's getting more and more complicated. Now, you might be wondering, at the beginning of the talk, I told you that, you know, once low dimensional chaos gets above like 3 or 4 dimensions, you can't really detect it in real data anymore. So how are we measuring whether this is chaotic or not? Well, the key observation is that whether or not you can determine something as chaotic really depends on whether you have the correct model for it that you can manipulate. So if you have a model that you can manipulate, you can look at how quickly trajectories diverge by, for example, computing the Jacobian matrix J in this slide. And you can then look and see what happens to some family of trajectories as they go forward. And you can then compute the spectrum of Lyapunov exponents that tells you exactly how chaotic the system is. And from that, you can get something called the Lyapunov dimension that provides a good estimate of the dimension of the chaotic attractor that the dynamics have. And you can do that just by counting Lyapunov exponents. So this comes back to this key point about, okay, if we can't detect chaos in economic data, does that must mean it's a useless concept? Well, not so, because it may make a very important difference in how you think about what the economy is doing if you realize that the endogenous dynamics of the economy are coming from chaotic motion and it's on some higher dimensional chaotic attractor, which then allows you can run your models and understand how different factors are affecting the endogenous dynamics. I also want to mention an analogy to the ergodic hypothesis. When chaos is high dimensional, the dynamics can't be learned due to the curse of dimensionality. This is related to why you can't detect it in the data. So in circumstances where you have an economic setting, or at least a game theoretic setting where we studied it, where the chaos is high dimensional, then what it means is that even if the two players are perfect econometricians, they can never form a model that beats just a stochastic process that allows them to predict what's going to happen. And so you really have a situation where the chaos becomes inevitable. You can't say, oh, well, you don't have a smart enough learning algorithm. If you're just smarter, you could find it. Well, no, unless you actually know the structure of the economy and you know what all the other players in the economy are doing so that you can simulate the economy exactly, then you're stuck having chaotic dynamics because the motion's inherently unpredictable. So it's a kind of a self-reinforcing argument. And by the way, since I'm mentioning the ergodic hypothesis, you know, this underpins statistical physics. This basic fact that chaos is generic, if you boil down what is the ergodic hypothesis underpins statistical mechanics. You know, people have been trying to prove the ergodic hypothesis for more than a century unsuccessfully. But what people know who study these kind of things is when you start looking at high dimensional systems with nonlinearities, then the generic thing you see is high dimensional chaos, which means that it's as if the motion is ergodic. All right. Now, you might at this point say, well, what happened? Maybe what you're seeing is just a property of this learning algorithm that you happen to use. And so that set us off to try and study other learning algorithms. So we've actually looked at 8 different learning algorithms. And, so we looked at a wide variety of algorithms: experience-weighted attraction, fictitious play, pure reinforcement learning. We even looked at things like level K learning. So under level K learning, you assume each player believes believes they can look ahead by some number of moves. They believe they can look ahead one more move than the other player. And so they model what the other player is doing if that other player is learning. And they say, but I'm just a little bit smarter. I'm going to look one move ahead. That's exactly what people who were betting on those spikes were doing in the Keynesian game that I showed you earlier. And so we even include, the point being, we even include strategies that have forward reasoning. So these are players who are reasoning about the future and trying to think somewhat rationally, but don't think perfectly rationally. That is, they can't reason, they don't reason an infinite number of steps ahead, and they don't assume their partner is rational either. Now, so we studied again, two-player normal form games with finite n as before, but a key thing we did differently from before is we studied n equals 2, n equals 3, n equals 4, because the previous results I showed you were all for n being very large. That is for complicated games. Now we can look and see how things depend on how complicated the game is. And we also discovered that even though we studied all these different learning algorithms, a reasonable approximation is to use what's called a best reply dynamics. So in that, the players take turns. One player makes their move, then the other player makes their best reply to the opponent's last move. And then that player makes their best reply to that move, and you just keep going back and forth. So in other words, you can think about a diagram like this. So look at A first. Under best reply dynamics, if you're sitting there in the upper left edge, you first player looks and says, now what is my best move, given that the other player has moved, made a given move on the last turn. That they make their move, which then in this diagram might move us to the right. Then the other player makes their best move, that moves us down. Then the first player again makes their move, we now go to the left, and then the other player makes their move, and now we're back where we started. So that would be an example of a cycle in the best reply dynamics. You could also have fixed points. I show one down lower. In that case, when you have a fixed point, then that just corresponds to what's called a pure strategy Nash equilibrium, and everything just gets attracted into that value. You can also have cases where you don't immediately go onto a cycle, but eventually everything either goes on to a cycle or a fixed point. So you have attractors in this, depending on what the initial conditions are. And one of the nice things about best reply cycles, apart from the fact that it's simple to think about what's going on, is that under best reply dynamics, you could reduce everything to a game where the payoffs are zeros or ones. And so you can now think about it as some space of binary possibilities. That is, we can take what's going on in A and we can make a new game corresponding to B where everything's rounded to be a zero or one, and we get exactly the same best reply dynamics. So now, and I should really credit Marco Pangallo and Torsten Heinrich, who did this, now we can really think about things in terms of statistical mechanics and solve this under a microcanonical ensemble and count the frequency with which a given initial state will end up in a, either a cycle or a fixed point. And if it's a cycle of what length? So you can count how many cycles there are and look over the entire space of normal form games and compute the frequency with which you expect to see them. So at least for gamma equals zero, they were able to do that. And you can then just compute the share of best reply cycles. And then we can ask, well, how does that correspond with what we see in these other learning algorithms that we're looking at? So you can see here, reinforcement learning, fictitious play, replicator dynamics, experience-weighted attraction, experience-weighted attraction with noise, level K experience-weighted attraction. And then you can look at what happens when you use the best reply matrix with zeros and ones, or when you use the actual matrix that we had, and you know, compare this to simulations. And if we were replicating everything perfectly, then all these strategies would just lie along the diagonal line, the identity line. So you can see it's not perfect, but you can see, on the other hand, it's pretty close in lots of cases that and let me just be clear what's happening here. What we're looking at is the share of best reply cycles, that is, what fraction of possibilities for a given parameter value for n equals 20 and gamma equals zero, what fraction of those correspond to cycles. So if the answer is one on the y-axis, that means 100% of the cases had cycles. That is, there were no fixed points. If it's zero, it means the share was 100% fixed points. And if it's something in between, it means the share was somewhere in between. And so what you see is that when we compare what happens in the game to what happens with n equals 20 and gamma equals zero to what happens when we try and predict the frequency with which we're going to observe chaotic solutions, it's not perfect, but it's also not too bad. And this is maybe just to give you a little better feeling. I won't probably go through any of these in depth, but you see what happens under the different algorithms, both in terms of what the best reply cycle is going across the top row. So you see the map of a specific instance where you can see the case, where you can see the best reply dynamics, where you can see the cycle in this, like in A, there's a cycle and there's a fixed point. And then down below it, you see what the, you see two examples, like for replicator dynamics or fictitious play, of what actually happens when you run the game. In those cases, you see a cycle, and you also see cases where you're getting sucked into a stable fixed point. Now, and then we could study the probability of non-convergence depending on these parameters n and gamma. And what you see is that as you vary gamma, and you'll see the dashed line there looking at the number of actions, as we originally hypothesized 20 years ago, as the game gets more complicated because the number of actions goes up, you become less likely to converge. That becomes even stronger. So if you take the upper left, we have the case where gamma is minus 0.7. That is, you have a competitive game. And so when n is 2, already you see 20% of the time you're not converging to a fixed point. And as the number of actions goes up, by the time you get up to about n equals 10, virtually 100% of the time you're seeing cycles, which is very correlated with there being chaotic orbits. And you can actually see little symbols for what happened when we ran simulations with the different learning algorithms, showing that most of the time we do a reasonably good job of getting the right answer. One exception you can see in the top one is fictitious play, where for large n, we often get the wrong answer. But other than that, most of them it's a reasonable approximation. And you see the basic dynamics that we hypothesized. As n goes up, the fraction that are not, that go to chaotic orbits gets bigger. Also, as gamma decreases, it becomes a less likely that happens. So in other words, the bottom line conclusion is that equilibrium is unlikely when games are complicated and competitive. That is, if you have more than two players, you kind of automatically have a complicated game. If you have more than a few possible actions, or if the competitive part means the incentives aren't lined up. So if your incentives are lined up, we'll call that a non-competitive game. If your incentives are lined up, that's a competitive game. Once you have a competitive game, and once either the number of players or the number of actions gets large, the probability that you're going to have chaos becomes large, which is the main punchline of my talk. Now, let me go to the next slide. Now, of course, one complaint you might make about this is that these are normal form games. How closely do normal form games resemble the economy? Well, I mean, normal form games are often used as models for what the economy might do, but still, there's a good point there. Things are different. My gut feeling is that normal form games are like the best case. I can't prove this, but in normal form games, you don't really have built-in dynamics in the same way. I'm mentioning, when I say stability matters, Kars Hamas has done a bunch of experiments, his group, building on earlier experiments by Vernon Smith, showing that if you have a setup in an economic experiment where the outcome is unstable, then you very easily end up in situations where you see oscillations in the strategy space and the players don't settle down to an equilibrium. And so that's independent of how complicated the game is. So here's another factor that should be taken into account and that we can't study by studying normal form games. I want to stress that the chaotic solutions that we saw in all of the simulations I've been doing here are not equilibria. That is, they're certainly not rational expectations equilibria. The outcomes don't match expectations. And they are there because the players are boundedly rational, because they don't fully take the other player into account, and they have overshoots and undershoots. And, you know, this is also what we see in lots of simple models. So I'm going to end with a few more economics examples. You know, made a model paper led by Yuki Asano, which, by the way, is just about to appear in PNAS. We took a standard macro model called the RCK model, and where a rational representative household chooses a savings rate to maximize discounted consumption. So in other words, there's one household in the world, that household owns the only firm in the world, that household works for the firm, and the household makes one decision, which is how much to save. And so, and you can show when you run that model, which, you know, dates back to Solow, that when you in that model, there is an optimal decision for the household to make that will maximize the long range consumption of the household. Now, so we took that model and just modified it in a really simple way. We assumed there were a lot of different households, not just one. They have a social network so that each household can observe what other households are doing. And each household can observe the savings rate and the consumption of the other households. So households have no rationality at all. They just simply copy their neighbors. So once every tau periods, they wake up, they look around at their neighbors, they pick out the neighbor that's consuming the most at that point in time, they copy their savings rate, and then they hold that savings rate until they suddenly wake up again, according to a Poisson process. So extremely simple cognition, extremely low level of bounded rationality. Now, we observed something quite remarkable in that model, and maybe I'll show this first. We, you know, under some circumstances, you just settle into a fixed point, but in others, you actually see oscillations. So here we see oscillations. So in the upper left panel, you see the aggregate savings rate, the average savings rate of the households in black, and you see three different households. You see how their savings rates are changing through time, and you see households are actually alternating between saving a lot and saving a little. And then the result is, when you look at the output in the lowest slide, you see that the output of the economy is oscillating. And with oscillating in some way that depends on how the savings rate's oscillating. And in fact, here's another view of what's going on. So we're plotting the savings rate on the y-axis and the interval between when the households wake up on the x-axis. And we see that when this interval is really short, so the households are just waking up all the time and paying lots of attention, then they get stuck in a poverty trap where the savings rate is very close to zero. The color indicates how many households, black means no households have that savings rate. A bright color means lots of households have the savings rate. So you can see out of the 1,000 or so households, most of them are concentrated around zero. But as you crank tau up, you see the savings rate increasing. And in fact, if you compare it to what the rational agent would have done, which is that dashed yellow-green line, that's called the, You compare to what the rational household would have done, which is the white line. So the rational household here would save 50% and invest, consume 50% and save 50%. So that's the white line. The dashed green line is just a statistical mechanics style estimate we made for what the model's doing, and that kind of blue-green line is an average of what they actually did. What you see is, as you increase tau, once tau gets up to around 100, you're getting very close to the golden mean. So it looks like you're remarkably actually getting close to recovering what the rational household would have done. But just as you get there, you see you start to make this oscillation where you spontaneously get both inequality, and that you have some households that are very rich and some households that are very poor, corresponding to the ones that have a high savings rate become rich, the ones with a low savings rate are poor, and the economy oscillates because the number of households in each group changes through time. And so you see something that looks like a business cycle that just came for nothing. But interestingly, the average savings rate stays very close to the golden mean, even though individual households, very few of them or none of them, have that savings rate. I'll give you one more example and then I'll quit. This is a model we made for the crisis, the great financial crisis. We were trying to recover the idea that that stock volatility in the run-up to the crisis got very low as the market was rising, coinciding with leverage increasing, the black line. And then just as the crisis happened, there was a huge spike in leverage followed by a collapse. And similarly, the low volatility stopped, and then there was a huge spike in volatility. So can we see behavior that looked kind of like that? So there's a model we made with Christoph Eymans, Fabio Caccioli, and Vincent Tan. Very simple model. We have two agents, a bank and a fundamentalist, one risky asset plus cash. We assume the bank uses an exponential moving average of historical volatility to estimate its expected volatility, that the bank uses the Basel II risk management rule to set a leverage target. So as things get more volatile, they lower their leverage and vice versa. We assume that supply equals demand, so that the prices are set by matching the supply and demand of the bank and the fundamentalist, and that the fundamentalist buys undervalued assets and vice versa. Extremely simple model. I can reduce it to a seven-dimensional map. And when you look at what this seven-dimensional map does, this is what it does in the absence of any noise at all. In the absence of noise, if the banking sector is small, or if the taste the banking sector has for leverage is small, then everything just settles into a fixed point. Leverage, prices, all just settle into a fixed value. But once you make the banking sector large, and or if you turn up the amount of leverage they're allowed to use, then you start to just see spontaneous oscillations where you have a 10 to 15 year rise followed by a crash. And one can demonstrate that this is a chaotic attractor. To use an example that Jean-Philippe actually introduced me to, which is pole balancing, if you try to balance a pole in your hand, it turns out that if the pole is longer than a meter, it's pretty easy to do. If the pole is shorter than a meter, it's impossible. I'm going to now try and do it with a pole that's only about 2 feet, so it won't really work. But you can see I can almost balance this pole. And so imagine I had a longer pole, And it was, and I was balancing it. Well, of course I can't balance it perfectly. The question is why? So in a traditional model, the explanation would be a traditional model being like a standard rational expectations macro model would be that, well, you have somebody who can balance the pole perfectly, but there are gusts of wind that knock the pole out of balance. Every time a gust of wind knocks it out of balance, the perfect pole balancer moves his hand exactly to compensate and bring it back into balance, but then another gust of wind hits it. But of course, that's not what, that could be the case. If you try and balance a pole in a really, in a hurricane, you're going to experience that. But, you know, you can see that even in a perfectly still room, the pole will still oscillate, and the pole's oscillating. The angle of the pole relative to vertical is oscillating because people are imperfect pole balancers and they tend to overshoot and undershoot. And they do it in a characteristic way that's interacting with the dynamics of the pole. The pole's like an inverted pendulum. And so they, in fact, I happen to note that you can calculate that 1 meter is the critical threshold by just assuming the pole is a pendulum and making a reasonable estimate about how quickly people can react. And so in fact, you have endogenous dynamics because there's an imperfect pole balancer corresponding to some chaotic response to a control mechanism. And that's ultimately got to be what a lot of the dynamics in the economy is about. And so the business cycles, I believe, once we have better boundedly rationality models that take into account the ways in which we are imperfect planners, then we will see business cycles emerge naturally. I just want to emphasize that the two models I showed you don't have utility functions, rational agents, or perfect maximizers. And on that note, I'll end my talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Doin. So I think your seminar dovetails extremely well with what I've been trying to say in my 8 lectures, in particular in the one that just happened before this. In particular, what you said at the end, that business cycles don't necessarily need any exogenous shocks to exist. This is something that I discussed last week within a model of firms interacting and assuming simple dynamics. We get a phase where indeed we get all these oscillations or chaos out of nowhere, just because firms are not able to coordinate and synchronize and get it right. So overall, I agree with everything you said, and I did like a lot your work with Tobias Gala, which actually I talked about very quickly just a few minutes ago. I have a few questions. One is, when you talk about this recent work of Baudry et al., you mentioned the fact that they have an oscillation, a business cycle, and you said it's too periodic to be realistic. But I guess that in most of these models, the parameters are assumed to be fixed in time. And I guess this is not very natural. I mean, we like having models that are, you know, have parameters that fix in time. But I think that in a way, one should be prepared to allow these parameters to fluctuate slowly in time. And I think this would allow the periodicity of these cycles to, you know, not to be strictly constant. So do you have any view on that?
Yeah, no, I agree with you that you know, any model with fixed parameters is going to be an approximation because, you know, there's endogenous growth, structural change in the economy.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, mortgage-backed securities are a good example. They didn't exist, and then when they did exist, you know, they totally disrupted the global economy. But I guess the question is two things. It's not that in principle you could have a limit cycle, and then you could be changing parameters as due to structural change that would then vary the periodicity of that limit cycle to explain why business cycles vary so much. You know, business cycles is a complicated story. The U.S., it turns out, has a particularly regular business cycle. It's still not that regular, but it's quite regular relative to many other countries. I mean, Australia has almost doesn't have a business cycle. And so when you start looking across different countries, they vary quite widely, even though I'll also mention Marco Pangallo's thesis, where he studied synchronicity. So there's a lot of, one of the interesting facts about business cycles is it takes remarkably little coupling between the economies of two countries for their business cycles to affect each other. Mm-hmm. But I guess in a bigger picture, so I think you're right that we could imagine somebody, God's changing the parameters in the underlying dynamical system. But then, of course, we want to understand what's causing those parameters to change. We want to try and keep endogenizing things to understand that. Mm-hmm. And as we do that, then now we've got the endogenous irregularity built in, because I don't think we expect that's going to be very periodic. But you're right, the Bogri model might be a reasonable description of, for some particular set of parameters that we have right now, what things are doing. And those parameters, if we postulate the right changes through time, maybe we can get at that. Though I think the bigger problem is the fact that chaos is generic. Limit cycles generally only exist in a small band of the parameter space. And so we would have to have something, we'd really have to be very close to a fixed point for that to be
a good model. Totally agree. I was making a kind of general point that we, in physics, we're kind of wedded to models with a fixed value of parameters. I mean, the mass of the electron doesn't change. But I think that economics or finance are slightly different, and we should be prepared to have a kind of circle of approximations where we focus on some elements and try to understand them with fixed parameters, and then allow the model to be embedded in a bigger model where these parameters are themselves allowed to change and so on.
I totally agree. And I do like the Bodri paper.
The other comment I had was about this Keynesian two-third game that you mentioned that I'm playing with my students as well. And something that I realized is that people playing above 66, they're not crazy people. They're actually antisocial people. And this is a very interesting observation, I think, because I think people, antisocial behavior exists in the society and should be taken care of or accounted for. And so mm-hmm. the game I play in my class is that I actually give a reward. I mean, someone who comes up with the right answer has an extra point at his final exam. So there's an incentive to do it right. And of course, most people do exactly what you do. But one year I had one guy playing 100. And of course, this guy was not stupid, but he was just messing with other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very interesting, scenario that not only you can't expect people to be rational, but I think you should also account for people who are, playing aggravation. I mean, that are on purpose trying to destabilize the system in some way or another.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was I don't know if you have.
Well, it just underscores the challenge we have to deal with real people and their heterogeneous modes of behavior, which can be driven by all kinds of motivations that may be hard to capture.
Yeah.
I agree.
The other question I had was about your Gala and yours paper. I've always been slightly confused by the way the phase diagram depends on alpha, on the memory of agents. Because I think economists would kind of believe that if you go to longer memories, if you are able to observe on longer time scale, somehow you should converge to fixed point more easily. And it's exactly the other way around. So do you have an intuition for this? And in particular, you know how this phase boundary depends on n, on the number of moves in the game. Is there an interesting dependence on this critical alpha on n, which would allow to actually reconcile with the intuition that, you know, if you're able to learn on longer time scales, you're going to learn better?
So I'm trying to remember. I knew the answer to this. I'm trying to see if I can remember it right now. Let me first make a comment to your second, the second point you made there, which is that this blue line that I'm showing here, we could actually, Tobias could actually calculate that line analytically using some methods that were developed by a guy named Opper, and it's, you know, replica techniques.
So that's a large N limit already.
It's a large N limit. This whole game is large N limit.
Oh,
and we
actually
started with the analytic solution in the large N limit. Mm-hmm. And then we did the simulations to understand what it means.
Yeah, okay, you're right. I forgot that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this whole thing is in the large N limit, which is what motivated us to go to do the other results to see what happens in the lower N limit. Now, let me think again about your memory loss point. So you said an economist would argue that when alpha is going to zero, that you should be more, say it again, what your concern is there?
Well, it's not a concern. It's just naively that if you're, you know, in a very naive setting, you think that if you learn too fast, you're going to destabilize the whole process all the time. Whereas if you learn slowly, you're going to be able to converge to whatever you have to learn. So in a way that having a short memory is like increasing temperature or increasing noise. And it seems to go exactly the other way around here. So I was just trying to see if I could get the intuition right.
Well, I know we thought about that a lot, JP. I'm trying to remember why we concluded this makes sense. This paper is now a decade old.
Yes, I know.
I
read it several times, but I don't remember seeing an explanation for this point.
Yeah. We did think about that because I know we wrestled with that question before. Tell you what, why don't you ask me any other questions you have? And in the meantime, maybe I'll figure this out.
Remaining on the same graph, so there's this orange faced multiple fixed point, mm-hmm. and this is very much like in a kind of spin glass where there's an exponential number of solutions, which I think is extremely interesting. And I just talked about this before your seminar. I think in these systems, one interesting problem is that we don't even have the measure of these fixed points. So, you know, in general, you know, when we have indeterminacy of the equilibria or of the energies the system may go to, we have the Boltzmann weight that gives us an answer. But I think in many cases we don't know what are the basin of attractions and what are what is the correct weighting of these different fixed points that one should apply if we were to, I don't know, to average over a large population of two-player games doing stuff. So is there any way in this model to answer that?
No, not that I know of. I mean, you know, you can show, actually, a fellow named Opper, physicist named Opper, showed prior to us that the number of Nash equilibria is varying in this state space. So he studied that, and he showed that on the left of this blue curve, you get this proliferation mm-hmm. of Nash equilibria. And now, you can, if you think about it, you can understand how when the two players are both benefiting together, when their incentives are lined up, they naturally coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they coordinate and that's how they arrive at a fixed point. But when there's lots of Nash equilibria, there's lots of things they can coordinate on. And that's why you're getting that. Now, I don't know of any method where we could calculate the size of the basins of attraction of each of those in the original state space, but it could be that it would be possible to do that. And in particular, if I were going to attack it now, I would probably go think about it in terms of this best reply dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was thinking about this when you talk about this issue.
Though we really only got the best, we could only do the calculations with the best reply dynamics in a nice form when gamma was zero. Mm-hmm. That is, we could only really compute the fractions when gamma was zero.
Which is just at the boundary of the two.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this thing called the Edwards ensemble where Sam Edwards for the sandpipe problem, you know, where again, there's no Boltzmann weight, kind of postulated that all the equilibria were equiprobable. But I think it would be interesting to see at least numerically if there is something that can be said about not only the existence of these many fixed points, but also if they are more or less all equivalent. And so if you start from a random initial condition, do you fall on any of them with the same probability, or is there something you know, really subtle going on there?
Yeah, this is of course a question that standard game theorists and economists have worried about a lot, because as soon as you have more than one equilibrium, how do you select which equilibrium you're going to land on? And this is the, you know, version of that in a situation where things are really complicated.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess what's new here is that you tend to have an exponential number of them, which is, I guess, very new in the context of games.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I had many questions, but maybe the last one is about the lessons for the economy more generally of these models. So you talked about some examples, but for example, you say here, you know, that when there's competition, it's easy to get chaos and destabilize the system. Do you think this has a kind of broader type of scope, in the sense that we should make the economy less competitive in order to stabilize it? Or, you know, what can you draw as overarching lessons of all this beautiful type of models?
Well, I mean, at the first order, I would say we have to just realize that the reality is that there is chaos out there, and we need to have modeling methods that actually capture what it does. Because if the real economy is doing something like those states, like in these pictures, if we're assuming it's at a fixed point, we're trying to approximate that by a point. And we're trying to kick that point around in such a way that it actually mimics what it's really doing. And so it's just, the whole approach is not right. Now, on the other hand, your question is turning that around, saying, how can we, if we understand it, if we understand what's really causing a business cycle, now we have some hope of controlling the business cycle, because we actually have we understand the causal mechanisms that are really at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, you can make some guesses about some of them. Like if you go back to our model with the Basel leverage cycle, well, there's a parameter in there there are two parameters that are effectively the same from the dynamics of the model, which is how big is the banking sector and how much leverage is the banking sector allowed to take on? That is, how much leverage are they going to take when there's a given level of volatility? And that parameter determines whether it oscillates or not. So there, it's quite clear how you would do it. You just make a rule. You can't use very much leverage. And it's not surprising at all, because leverage is inherently destabilizing. If you have leverage, when prices go up, you buy, and when prices go down, you sell. So you're always buying into rising markets and selling into falling markets. And so you're automatically doing something destabilizing. And so you've got to limit the size of that instability. And we have another paper appearing in PNAS soon that is on market ecology. And what we're arguing there, we show it in a simple toy system, is if you can actually monitor how many how much money is invested in trend following strategies versus fundamental value strategies versus just noise traders, then that's a very good predictor of how big are the mispricings, how much excess volatility do you have in the sample market. And there's no reason a regulator can't do that in a real market, monitor what strategies have how much invested in them and exert something to control it, saying, excuse me, this strategy has to be limited right now, because mm-hmm. you're going to destabilize financial markets if you keep putting more money behind it. And so I do think that we could really use this to make the world a better place by regulating it to make it more stable.
Mm-hmm. Yes, totally. Well, I think we have to stop because we've been a little long, but that was great, I think. So thank you again. And, you know, until soon.
You're welcome. Jake, I did remember, by the way, this in that if you go back to how this dynamics works, this beta parameter is the temperature in this slide here. And when the temperature is high, it means everybody's just guessing at random all the time. Now, what I remember we did, this is not a complete explanation, but if you take this in the continuum limit, it turns out the only thing that matters is the ratio alpha over beta, which then acts like the Reynolds number, and which is what's causing you the chaos in there. And basically when beta over alpha is large, then the system automatically goes to a fixed point because it's the guesses are sufficiently random that everybody's just flipping coins. So you easily land at this fixed point. But when the opposite is true is when you get strong nonlinearities. And that's why that ratio acts like, because things are more deterministic. And when things are more deterministic, the system's becoming much more reactive. The edges all get sharper. The nonlinearities get stronger.
Oh, okay, I see. So in a sense, your fixed point is a kind of trivial fixed point. Okay.
Well, it's a kind of a trivial fixed point, except it's very close to the Nash equilibrium as long as, okay, if beta gets really big, then you start to move far away from the Nash equilibrium. But certainly when you come back to this diagram and you're, you know, reasonably close to that line, then you're reasonably close to the Nash equilibrium. And as you move deeper away, as alpha gets bigger and bigger, then you move farther and farther away from the Nash equilibrium.
Okay, I have to think about this because it's still not very clear to me, but okay, fine.
It's complicated. All right.
Well, thanks a lot.